around the area.
And people will say they've got legitimate concerns. But, I mean, briefly, if ministers did want to change this, why can't they just do it?
Well, we're not in a country where they tend to just change things. We know that when it comes to primary legislation, they do like to consult. We've just seen the Wes Streeting announcing changes to the sugar tax, which followed a consultation. We know that there's likely to be measures to do with pay per mile for electric car drivers in the budget tomorrow. But that will also come, most likely, I'm told, with a consultation. So it's not something that a government, or particularly this government, would unilaterally change.
No.
But maybe after the next election, if the way the polls go, we might have a different government in charge and one that are quicker to just change the laws unilaterally.
Ben Clatworthy, The Times' Whitehall editor, thank you very much for taking us through that story. It's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to The Times at One team for bringing the programme to you. Of course, tomorrow, the day will have arrived, the day of the budget, and I'll be here with Andrew Neil to give you all that post-budget analysis. But for now, Fee Glover and Jane Garvey are here with you for the next few hours.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Joe, and enjoy your budget day with Andrew. We'll all be tuning in here on Times Radio tomorrow. It's Joe and Andrew taking you through the details of the budget. Well, on the programme today, what have we got, Fee?
Well, in the next 2 hours, just the one sleep until that budget, with Rachel Reeves sitting out at her armchair critics. We'll hear what we can expect. Our big guest is very appropriately the businesswoman and new Lady Mayor of London, Dame Susan Langley. There is news beyond the budget too, with reports of an important breakthrough in the peace talks to end the war in Ukraine. And as a politician named after one of history's horrors is set for re-election in Namibia, we're going to talk about unfortunate names.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here until 4 on Times Radio. Here's the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. US media is reporting that Ukraine has agreed to a peace deal brokered by the Trump administration. CBS News, there are some minor details to be ironed out, but an agreement has been reached. Ukraine's national security chief says Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to visit the US at the earliest possible date. Rustem Umerov says the aim of that visit will be to complete the final stages of a peace agreement with Russia. Here, Sir Keir Starmer has been updating MPs. He said Russian aggression must be resisted.
There is only one nation that wants this war, only one nation that launched this illegal invasion, and only one nation that deploys a constant barrage aimed at murdering innocent civilians. We saw that again last night, Mr. Speaker, with Russia's strikes on Kyiv. Indeed, in the last week before last night, Russia launched over 1,200 drones and over 60 cruise and ballistic missiles at Ukraine.
David Lammy wants jury trials to apply only to murder, rape or manslaughter. The Times has seen a memo in which the Justice Secretary says to other ministers that drastic action is needed to cut a backlog of cases in Crown Courts in England and Wales. He's told other government departments there is no right to jury trials in the UK and drastic action is required. The Health Secretary has announced that the sugar tax will be extended to include milk-based sugary drinks. Wes Streeting says the soft drinks levy, which came into effect in 2018, will now include things like milkshakes and sweet milky coffees. They were previously exempt. It's thought the changes could cut 17 million calories from the nation's daily intake. Streeting has told MPs why the government is making this change.
Obesity robs children of the best possible start in life, hits the poorest hardest, sets them up for a lifetime of health problems and costs the NHS billions.
A man's been arrested in connection with the illegal dumping of rubbish in Oxfordshire. A 40-foot mountain of waste near Kidlington was declared a critical incident last week by the Environment Agency. The 39-year-old from the Guildford area was arrested earlier following cooperation between the Environment Agency and the South East Regional Organised Crime Unit. The surgeon who led the UK's first successful human heart transplant has died at the age of 93. Sir Terence English's daughter Mary says her family is immensely proud of him. Graham Linehan has been cleared of harassment but found guilty of criminal damage to a trans activist's phone. The comedy writer was involved in a confrontation at a conference in London last October. And a Thai woman's cremation has been halted after she was heard knocking from inside the coffin. The 65-year-old travelled 300 miles to a temple in the casket. The temple's manager said she must have been knocking for quite a while. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for a Times News briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. I could do without that story from Andy there about the knocking on the coffin. It comes up once every couple of years, doesn't it? You get one of those stories. Never good. Never good.
No, but well, in a way it is, Jane.
Yeah, I suppose. Okay, yes, the glass, I suppose, of that particular story, you could interpret it as being half full.
I think actually that's quite a good news story in terms of people who've been in coffins and the knocks haven't been heard.
Well, we don't hear those stories. You never get them, do you?
Well, exactly. So I think that we should say we embrace the knocking on a coffin stories.
This is why I like working with you. You just change my perspective. Right, there could be some good news today, as Fee was saying a little earlier. There might be a breakthrough in the talks between Russia and the US and Ukraine. Let's hope so. We'll have more on that a little bit later. George Parker of the FT joins us. He's going to talk about You Know What, which is tomorrow. A cash ISA rate war already underway, apparently, because of all the rumours around a possible cut in the tax-free cash ISA limit. They're saying it could drop to £12,000 from £20,000. We've got the health news today with Dr. Rachel Ward. That's always worth listening to. We're talking about moody dogs. Don't be cross with your animal. They can't help it. It could well be in their genes. And we'll go to Italy, where a man's been arrested after dressing up as his late mother in order to claim her pension. Meanwhile, in Namibia, a 59-year-old man with the name Adolf Hitler has won a local election. And our big guest is that Lady Mayor.
It is that Lady Mayor. So it's Dame Susan Langley, who is the 697th head of the City of London Corporation and the first to take the title of Lady Mayor. So she gets the job for a year. Every Lord or Lady Mayor just stays in post for a year in order to stop an abuse of power. Mm. And if you thought it was just a ceremonial role because the Lord Mayor's show is a great big fandango of a thing, you would be wrong. There is all of that pomp and circumstance, but also it's an important ambassadorial role for the City of London. So there are several trips abroad for every Lord or Lady Mayor of London to try and reassure the rest of the world that the City of London is still the beating heart of the financial services industry. So that is so important at the moment. And as Susan Langley says, we've really got to keep our place in the world because it is the generator of so much income for the rest of the UK. So she comes in, we talk about all kinds of things, and she's also going to do an interview with us in a year's time to tell us what she genuinely thinks she has achieved during her tenure.
Look forward to it. Nick says, ladies, I've heard nothing on the budget for literal minutes. I hope you're going to do a deep dive.
We're not going to disappoint you, Nick.
No, we're not.
We wouldn't do that.
What are the most read stories on the Times website?
I'm so sorry, but in at number three, it is your favourite story. Oh. Cremation halted after dead woman heard knocking on coffin, and dead is obviously in inverted commas. You heard the story in the news there, a 65-year-old Thai woman who had arrived at a temple near Bangkok after a 300-mile journey, only for her to wake up to the disbelief of her grieving family. The second most read story, taxes have ruined our market town and we can't take any more. Times are tough in the Norfolk town of Diss and many blame the Chancellor's national insurance and minimum wage hikes. And the most read piece on the Times website so far today, I didn't start it, miss. Keir Starmer leads pupils in band dance. The Prime Minister performed the 6-7 trend. Do you want to do it in your proper kind of on-the-street lingo?
I've only very loosely heard of this. I don't even know how you do it.
Okay. I think you do have to kind of go 6-7. But because we have had a long time at the BBC reading things out, we say 6-7. So Keir Starmer has been doing this, and he's performed it when reading with primary school children before learning that they're usually told off for doing so. And there is nothing quite as delicious and delightful as seeing a prime minister or a leading politician trying to get down with the kids with usually disastrous consequences. So we wish him the very best of luck. Take a look if you like. Lots of people are doing that. If you would like to get access to all of these stories and you don't yet have a digital subscription, just get one.
Yeah.
That's our simple advice. Just get one.
OK, we're here, whether you like it or not, and you can contact us on WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. It's Times Radio. Good afternoon. We're less than 24 hours away from the budget. Rachel Reeves has announced that MPs are unlikely to welcome all the measures she'll announce. She's expected to include about £30 billion worth of tax rises. Let's bring in George Parker, Financial Times political editor. Before we actually get onto the budget, it is worth saying that the Times is now reporting, and this is a very big story, it could be a huge change to our national life, actually. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, proposing to scrap jury trials for most offences, keeping them only for alleged rapists and murderers. What do you think of this, George?
To be honest, the first I've heard of it. That is an incredible story. And presumably the intention is to speed up the dispensing of justice. But as you say, it's a memo seen by the Times. David Lammy, it's written to other ministers and civil servants, say that there was no right to a jury trial in the UK. And I think lots of people will find that very strange, because I think a lot of people think that under habeas corpus and all that, that people do have a right to be tried by their fellow citizens. So, yeah, I mean, that sounds like a very, very big change on a day of lots of other big political news.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for bearing with me there, George. I didn't fully appreciate that you weren't entirely up to speed, but you coped,
that's right.
You coped manfully, and we're very grateful. Alison Saunders, former Director of Public Prosecutions, is going to join us on this after 3 o'clock this afternoon. So, budget then. We certainly have been told endlessly over the last couple of weeks that she mustn't upset the bond markets. Why not?
Well, we spend about £100 billion a year on paying interest on the money the country's borrowed to pay for its colossal debts. A lot of it, as Rachel Reeves likes to constantly point out, goes to American banks and hedge funds. About 8%, that's £1 in every 12 or so of public spending, is spent on just paying the debt, the interest on the debt we've run up. And so the bond markets are the people who basically lend money to Britain to pay for the things we can't afford to pay for by raising taxes. So we rely on the kindness of strangers. If we want to be less reliant on the bond market, we have to stop borrowing so much money from the bond markets. And that's why she's so determined to assure them that the public finances are on a sound footing. And with that, she hopes to bring down the interest rate that the bond markets are charging the rest of us to borrow their money.
So presumably the bond markets wanted a rise in income tax, which is one of the things she can't deliver.
Exactly. The bond markets liked that because they thought that it was a sign that Rachel Reeves was strong. She was prepared to do politically unpopular things. She was prepared to put the public finances on a very solid footing by raising a tax, which she ruled out doing in the manifesto. And she was unable to do it. And of course, the bond markets took fright at that. You saw the cost of government borrowing went up sharply the day after we broke that story in the FT. And because the other thing that they're worried about is that, you know, who's writing this budget? Who's in charge? Is it Rachel Reeves, someone they broadly trust to run public finances in a sensible way? Or is it the parliamentary Labour Party, a load of left-wing Labour MPs, as they probably would see them in the city? And that was a sign, I think, that they were worried that it's the Labour MPs who are writing the budget. So whether that's not putting up income tax or the thing we're expecting tomorrow, the ending of the two-child benefit cap, which is a cause beloved of Labour MPs, all those things give the market cause for pause, basically.
And this is where you have to attempt to understand that Rachel Reeves has got to appease some parts of her own political party, and she has to have the bond markets feeling more secure as well. I mean, it's just about impossible. The mansion tax does sound on the face of it like something guaranteed to appeal to many Labour MPs.
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's part of the political package, the idea that the people with the broader shoulders are paying more. It's the sort of what's left of the wealth tax agenda that Labour MPs have been talking about for quite a while. This idea that if you own a house worth more than £2 million, you'll pay an annual surcharge on your council tax. But even that's proved difficult, actually, because the problem is that the Labour Party now represents a load of constituencies where these alleged mansions are located. Mm. For example, Kensington and Chelsea. So you had a last-minute lobbying operation by Labour MPs saying, hang on a sec, we can't have it at 1.5 million, the threshold, let's move it up. So as a result, it's going to be on two properties worth over £2 million. And in the end, it doesn't raise all that much money for Rachel Reeves.
Well, we're told it could be, what, 500 million, something like that, which is enormous, but not ginormous.
Yeah, well, in the context of that £30 billion you were talking about earlier, it's not a huge amount of money. And, of course, it doesn't come in immediately because houses will have to be revalued. There'll be lots of appeals, no doubt. So it's probably going to be another 3 years before the Treasury sees a single penny out of this mansion tax. But from a political optics point of view, if you're going to be asking people, ordinary working people, to pay more in income tax, which they will do because they've got this, one of the probably the biggest single measure in the budget will be the freezing of thresholds at which you start paying different rates of tax. Well, if that means everybody's going to end up paying more tax in a few years' time. And if you want to ask ordinary people to pay more tax, you've got to show that the wealthy are paying their share as well.
Yeah, OK. Now, cash ISAs, a lot of people are exercised by this. And indeed, the banks are and the providers generally are getting together and they're having a rate war at the moment to try and attract fresh customers, because it would seem that the tax-free limit is going down possibly to 12 grand. And I think at some point there was talk of £5,000, wasn't there? What are you hearing?
Yeah, we've been reporting today that it will go down to £12,000. This is the cash ISA limit. So at the moment, you can save up to £20,000 in cash, tax-free. That's been going to be cut to £12,000. And the idea here is that the £20,000 limit for all ISAs will remain. So you could still save another £8,000 tax-free, but, this is the big but, you'll be forced to do that in terms of investments into stocks and shares. And that's one of the big things that Rachel Reeves wants to do. She wants to see more of the country's savings going into the stock market and therefore into companies that create jobs and wealth and growth in the economy. So her view is, why are we giving people tax breaks just to save their money in a cash account when they could be doing some slightly more risky stuff, which in the long term, all analysis seems to show, will provide better returns for individual savers.
Yeah, but how do you sell that to people who are, frankly, nervous about risk? And it's no fun if you do have a stocks and shares ISA. Sometimes, you look at it and it's just gone. You've lost loads of money in a week. Whereas, I'll be honest, I've also got a cash ISA, which just trundles along very, very nicely, very reassuring.
Yeah, so that's true. It's a difficult sell. I think what Rachel Reeves will do, and I have to say that Rachel Reeves and her fellow ministers haven't been particularly good at selling difficult things to a sceptical public, so I think hold your breath on that. But they'll look at a place like America, where people save a lot more money in Wall Street, basically, and get better long-term returns. So you're right that in the short term, if you've got money in a stocks and shares ISA, it goes up and it goes down quite an alarming way. But all the analysis shows that over a 10-year period, for example, you're going to make more money having your money in the stock market than you do just sitting in a cash account.
Yeah, OK. Do you think that the coverage tomorrow will be all about something no one has talked about at all but ends up being the headline of this 2025 budget?
It's possible. So Rachel Reeves was addressing the Parliamentary Labour Party last night. And she said there will be some brilliant things in the budget and a couple of things that people don't know about yet. I think, we're going to hear a bit more about the National Health Service. I think there's going to be a bit more on that. I'm sure there'll be stuff to help people with the cost of living. That's something she's talked about as well. So those will be the kind of things she'll be hoping to get headlines for. My guess is that the headlines in a lot of the papers will be, if, as we expect, she removes the two-child benefit cap and we know she's putting up people's taxes, that people will say that she's just basically putting up your taxes to pay for a load of people on benefits because the Labour Party can't cut the welfare bill. I suspect that will be the big criticism from the Conservative Party echoed in a lot of the papers tomorrow.
OK, and the misogyny that she has acknowledged herself, she's been very public about it. In fairness, sometimes she's been public about it because somebody has asked her a direct question about alleged misogyny and then she hasn't constantly banged on about it herself. But it is nevertheless true. I think I was about 14 when a woman became Prime Minister. In my 60s, by the time a woman became Chancellor, it's not easy, is it?
It's not. And if you look at the approval ratings for Rachel Reeves, they're the worst, according to Ipsos anyway, of any chancellor in the last 50 years since they've been doing polling. And you have to ask yourself why that is. I mean, she's made mistakes, and a lot of people will be shouting at the radio and saying, well, what about this? What about those things she's done? But, you know, Rachel Reeves hasn't crashed the economy yet. She's not taken us out of the EU and caused massive damage to the economy. She's not done a whole load of really, really bad and crazy stuff. Yet she's the most unpopular chancellor in history. And so I think she asks, and some people do ask, you know, is it partly to do with the fact that she's a woman, the derogatory comments about her being Rachel from accounts and all that sort of thing. And it's something, rightly or wrongly, she believes is a factor in the way that she's treated in the media and by some of her political opponents.
Interesting. Thank you very much indeed, George. George Barker, political editor of the Financial Times.
And it is interesting, isn't it, Jane, that some male politicians have come out completely on Rachel Reeves' side. James Cleverly has said, yes, she definitely is viewed with a different lens to the way other people have been viewed. If you only wanted to judge your chancellor on contents and on facts, if you only wanted to judge your leaders on contents and facts, you don't have to go too far back in our recent political history to see quite a lot of men not being quite across their content and facts. But it's a different part of the very focal lens that they're being viewed through. Would you agree?
I certainly would. I can't imagine who you're referring to there, but we've had one or two hapless gents running things, haven't we, over the last decade or so.
Well, one or two hapless chancellors, Jane, doing untold things to the economy. And I'm sure, you know, men and women listening to this afternoon will be able to conjure up exactly who we mean. The 6-7 trend, Victoria would like this explained because she doesn't know what we're talking about. And it's such a weird one. There's no reason why you would, actually, unless you are kind of kid and teenage adjacent. The 6-7 trend is a recent internet meme and slang term I'm reading now, Victoria, popular in 2025, that has no fixed meaning. It functions largely as an inside joke and a social signal for Generation Alpha. Originally, though, it does come from a song lyric. It comes from the 2024 rap song. It's one of Jane's favourites.
Oh, yeah.
Doot Doot 6-7 by Philadelphia rapper Skrilla, in which the number sequence is repeated. But the artist has stated he never assigned a specific meaning to the phrase. So it's just up there with random song lyrics of our time.
I just despair. I really do.
I think it's quite benign and quite harmless until it gets into schools, and then there are so many teachers who say it just drives them mad because somebody just says it, especially in maths or chemistry, or, you know, when you've got stuff up on a whiteboard and there's the number 6 and the number 7 and the whole class is going 6-7.
I think it might be in London anyway, school trip week, because my tube journey to work, both today and yesterday, crammed with the unmistakable squeal of a primary school trip on a London outing.
Well, probably because we work very close to Tower Bridge.
There are some attractions.
There are some things that people could come and see, aren't there?
I suppose there are. Maybe that's it. Right, next on Times Radio, why is a German dictator's name on the ballot in Namibia? It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
It's the day we've all been waiting for. Yes, Wednesday, Budget Day.
Woo!
Everybody's very excited. And, of course, on Thursday, we'll be speaking to the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, live.
Well, on Wednesday, we'll get you ready with a host of experts and analysts from 6 o'clock, and we're joined by Giles Corran and Edwina Curry. Some call them Jed Wiener at 9 o'clock.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Life's like a photo album. Mine bring back so many memories. That's a street party on VE Day. Me, 3 years old. Oh, here's me, 17, teddy boy. Our wedding. Didn't my Shirley look lovely? Holiday in Devon when the boys were small. They tower over me now. Oh, now these are the more recent ones on my phone. Oh, that's me and Kate enjoying a game of cards. She's my care professional from home instead. Kind, funny and very good at gin rummy. Since Shirley passed away, Kate comes to the house most days to help with the things I can't manage so well now. She's great company. I mean, the boys visit me most weekends, but they can't be here all the time, so home instead have really helped. I have the best quality care, but in my own home, from Kate. She's wonderful. Though she will have to let me win at cards now and again.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
We travel to explore, to learn,
to connect. At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Our itineraries are designed to help you explore and engage with your destination through its food, culture, and customs. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Choose from thousands of products. Wickes have options to suit every budget. Plus, with great offers now on, it's the perfect time to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom. Find your nearest showroom at wickes.co.uk.
Victoria says, sorry, what's a meme?
Oh, come.
Mike, on the other hand, says, you despair, Jane. Were you a Shang-a-Lang girl? What was the message there? Well, Mike, the lyric to that Bay City Rollers hit was extremely profound. From what I recall, it went, we sang Shang-a-Lang as we ran with the gang, singing do what do do be away. I mean, that's fine.
Yeah, it could mean whatever you wanted it to mean, Mike.
It's actually rather moving stuff.
Yep. A meme's just a thing, Victoria. But don't worry too much about it. It's just something that gets into the ether and kind of spreads around. Rosamond says, I asked my 11-year-old grandson what 6-7 means at the weekend, and he said quite resolutely that adults have no idea what it means, that all the kids know, and they're sworn to secrecy. That's brilliant, isn't it? Massive conspiracy by the 11-year-olds. Yes. It's 24 minutes past two. Adolf Hitler is set to win a landslide re-election in Namibia. Rather than that being the German dictator reborn, it is instead a Namibian local politician given the name by his father. Now, he insists his name is the only thing that he shares with Hitler. He's far from the only person cursed with a terrible name, such as the Peruvian footballer Osama bin Laden. Harry Wallop is a journalist and expert on names common and uncommon, it says here. Hello, Harry.
Good afternoon. I guess I think we're called onomasticians, people who study names for pleasure.
Are you? Well, gosh, we've learned something today. We're learning a lot today. This story is actually rather sad, isn't it? Because when you dig into it, this guy, he doesn't share any of those extraordinarily evil politics of Adolf Hitler. It's a name that his dad chose, not really understanding all of the connotations. It's a name that all his family have always known him by, and he doesn't want to change it.
Yes, it is slightly unusual. I mean, he comes from a bit of Namibia that was part of the German Southwest Africa. It was a former German colony. I do find it slightly odd that anyone was alive in the 20th century who didn't know who Adolf Hitler was. But let's just take him at his word that his father plucked the name because he just heard it and thought it sounded nice. But it is deeply, deeply unfortunate. I mean, there are no Adolfs born in Britain because every year the ONS publishes all the data for baby names of any baby with more than three iterations of that name. So it is possible there was one or two Adolfs, but there certainly weren't three Adolfs last year, according to the official data.
It is an interesting list, that one, isn't it? Because for a couple of years, there were no Ians either.
Yeah, well, Nigel's very close to falling completely out. There were only five Nigels last year, only three Gileses. There were no Pierses. Pierses are officially over. There were seven Lucifers.
Whoa.
So Lucifer was more popular name than either Piers, Giles or Nigel.
Right, OK, I feel a massive feature piece coming on, Harry. how often do terrible names like Adolf Hitler crop up, though, in those kind of circumstances where somebody hasn't quite realised what they've done?
Well, the rules in the UK are you can basically call your child anything with the exception that it is possible for the registrar. A, it has to fit within the box. So there is a sort of a character limit. And the registrar is allowed to intervene if they think the name is unsuitable or is likely to lead to ridicule for the child. So there was a very sad case a few years ago where a mother wanted to call her child Cyanide. They were twins, Cyanide and Preacher. Preacher is an absolutely fine name, slightly unusual. Cyanide, she claimed, was because, well, it must be a good name because that's what Hitler took to kill himself. She obviously clearly had slightly mental health issues and the children were taken away and the judge, it went to court. So her the mother was represented and fought for saying it was a good name, but the judge decided that actually that was inappropriate.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you could basically call your child anything, give or take.
OK, so in those circumstances, who is it that ends up taking the parent to court? Is it the registrar who kind of alerts the authorities?
You're now straying beyond my level of actual intimate knowledge. Yeah, I presume it was in family court, so I presume someone was representing the children, the appropriate adult, as it were, because they were newborn children, and someone was representing her.
Right.
But there were 10 Bonnie Blues born last year, and they were all allowed, but obviously they were born, I think, before the Bonnie Blue incident, and I don't think that would stop anyone being called Bonnie Blue.
Right. Oh, goodness me. We're not the only country where people are getting it wrong, aren't we? There are some extraordinary examples from New Zealand. In 2008, a judge made a young girl a ward of court so she could change the name that she had been given, which was Tallulah Does the Hula from Hawaii. I mean, why would any parent want to give that to a child?
Well, this is interesting. So what's happened in the last couple of decades is there's been a proliferation in the variety of names. So there used to be, give or take, 2,000 to 3,000 different names every year in the UK. And that has increased to about 6,000. So we've doubled the pool of names. And this all comes down to essentially internet culture. And also a desire to become a brand. We all have to be a brand now. And there's a sort of a logic here. I think in the days of, you know, John Smith or Mary Wilson, you go to, in the early days of Hotmail, you were like John Smith 123. And now you have to be John Smith 123456789. So I think parents want their kids to stand out, to have an identity, to be a bit different. You know, I was one of 5 Harrys in my class, and I interviewed some mother who gave her child the name Triptych Alabama Bliss, and her the sibling to Dionysus Cosmo Chaos and Hieronymus Vladimir Azax. And I interviewed them for the Sunday Times, and she pointed out the mother was Olivia. She said it was the most common name in Britain. I just wanted my children to stand out.
Right. Are you a Harold on your actual birth certificate? Are you a Henry, or are you just a straightforward Harry?
I'm actually a Henry, and I hate Henry, and luckily I've never been called it. But yeah, no, I'm a Henry, and it confuses passports, because in post 9/11, of course, you now have to travel your passport. It's the only document that has Henry on. It has to match your ticket. In the old days, everyone understood it. You just said, oh yeah, it's Prince Harry. In fact, Prince Harry, as in the Duke of Sussex, is technically a Henry. So I used to go, it's like Prince Harry, but passport control people don't have a sense of humour about this.
And do you know whether or not you can go outside of an actual name? I mean, Elon Musk has named one of his children X, and then it's a diphthong, isn't it? A12 Musk.
So that is one of the other rules that are, I mean, the rules are very loose in the UK, but yes, characters are not allowed because that causes confusion. So it does have to be names. But there are all sorts of strange names. You know, there's lots of just initials. So there were 5 kids called TJ last year, and lots of, like, you know, AJ is very common, spelt both AJAY and just the letters AJ. So you can do pretty much anything, but characters are not allowed because, again, that might lead to ridicule.
Well, Harry, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. That's Henry Wallop, as we shall now be calling him. Don't worry, we won't.
Don't worry, we won't.
Another couple of examples from New Zealand. Officials blocked the following: Sex Fruit, Keenan Got Lucy, and Yeah Detroit. But they had allowed, and I can't believe this to be true, Jane, Number 16 Bus Shelter, Violence, and Midnight Chardonnay. Sorry, it's taken you to a place beyond 6/7.
Yes, it has, actually. I thought that was going to be our light and chirpy item of the afternoon. It's made me a bit depressed. Anyway, I'm sure with a name like Harry Wallop, he was left well alone at school. Now, coming up on Times Radio, a truly bizarre case of identity theft has hit the headlines in Italy. Yes, it's grim. That's another grim one. We'll tell you all about it in the next half hour. First on Times Radio, 2:30, here are the headlines. Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. David Lammy wants jury trials to apply only to murder, rape or manslaughter. The Times has seen a memo in which the Justice Secretary says to other ministers that drastic action is needed to cut a backlog of cases in Crown Courts in England and Wales. US media is reporting that Ukraine has agreed to a peace deal brokered by the Trump administration. CBS News says there are some minor details to be ironed out, but an agreement has been reached. Ukraine's national security chief says Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to visit the US at the earliest possible date. Here, Keir Starmer has been updating MPs. He says the violence unleashed by Russia remains horrific.
Last night, as a family, we celebrated my daughter's 15th birthday. Later, I saw images on the news of a young girl, about the same age, being pulled from the rubble of a building in Ukraine, where her mother had just been killed. It's abhorrent. It's beyond belief.
Pre-prepared milkshakes and iced coffees will no longer be exempt from a tax on sugary drinks. The Health Secretary has confirmed the move ahead of tomorrow's budget. It won't affect beverages made on site in cafes and restaurants. And a man's been arrested in connection with the illegal dumping of rubbish in Oxfordshire. A 40-foot mountain of waste near Kidlington was declared a critical incident last week by the Environment Agency. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar, and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programmes and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or with a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
Hello, John Pienaar. Yeah. We're talking about names. Are you just a plain John or are you actually Jonathan Pienaar?
I'm John. When I was a kid, my parents sometimes called me Jonathan, but it was more like a sort of, I don't know, a pet name.
And they were shouting at you, oh, a pet name.
No, it was when they were in a good mood with me, yeah. Oh.
How often were they in a good mood with you?
It's such a long time ago.
Oh, John, don't be modest. David says, and I don't believe this, but it's funny. Many years ago, I worked with somebody who called his twin daughters Bacardi and Coke. No, you didn't, David.
They were Malibu and Pineapple.
Exactly. We all know that. A quick one from Lorraine. Our parents, probably dictated by our mother, named us Lorraine, Vanessa, that's V-E, that's unusual, Vanessa and Melanie, back in the 70s to make sure we didn't have a common name. None of us like our names, she says. It's hard to get right, actually. I don't like my name much. And it's just, well, what can you do?
Well, you could have changed it.
To Bernard. John, what have you got?
So, I mean, story's breaking, yeah, as we speak. I'm really struck, seriously struck, by a story that's just popped up on the front of the Times in the last few moments. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, is floating an idea to abolish trial by jury from all but the very most serious crimes, yeah. Murder, manslaughter and rape.
Just to say, we are going to talk to Alison Saunders about that, former DPP. She's on after three. Carry
on. So I'm going to be talking to leading lawyers. I'm talking to Robert Buckland, the former Justice Secretary and Lord Chancellor, David Calvert-Smith. I'm anticipating a really strong reaction from the legal establishment, and we'll just see how that flies. The right of trial by jury, we're told about this, from early age.
Is it a right?
Well, in long fraud cases, for example, they've done away with. So it's not an absolute right. It's a qualified right. But to do away with it for pretty much every crime, apart from murder, manslaughter and rape, that is really something no one's floated before. So it's going to be so interesting to explore that. Also going to be talking about Ukraine, of course. So much diplomacy going on. What does it really add up to, again? I mean, we've had, the BBC reporting earlier on, there's agreement by Ukraine for a peace plan in Abu Dhabi, where officials have been talking. But agreement on what? I don't think they've agreed on the biggest and most important stuff. And Zelensky is off to Washington, apparently, later on this week. I guess maybe the most important thing is the ball is still in play. Trump hasn't walked away. And Putin, well, he's just sitting there, watching it all play out and sending the bombs in.
Yeah, there was a big attack last night, wasn't there? We shouldn't forget this. It's still going on.
Yeah, that's the reality. I mean, they say it's hope that kills you, but in Ukraine, they know what kills you.
Yeah.
And it's Putin.
Well, honestly, I think all of us would love there to be some sort of agreement on this, because it is just so disturbing. Thank you very much, John. John Pienaar with us on Times Radio between 4 o'clock and 7. Now, let's venture to Italy and hear the story of, a lady who had been called Graziella Dall'Aglio. Now, she arrived to renew her ID card, but there were just a few hints at the town hall that things were a trifle off. Staff noticed that she had quite a thick neck, unwrinkled hands, and what they described as the occasional slip into a slightly deeper voice. And then they realised the person in front of them might not be Graziella. In truth, it turned out that the person in front of them was her son, a middle-aged man who was trying to impersonate his late mother in an attempt to collect her pension. He has now been arrested. James Imam is a journalist in Milan. So what do we know about all this, James? It's rather unpleasant stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, well, your introduction was absolutely perfect. That's exactly how it played out. A man who appeared to be a woman.
We just can't hear him, can we?
No, so I think we're going to try and redial the line. All of you are getting involved about names. And do you know what? Even if your stories are apocryphal, they're providing us with a decent distraction this afternoon.
Some are, of course, unusable. But anyway.
Steve says, in the 1980s, I once worked with a chap with the surname of Jones who had named his daughter Cindiana. And Ian from Raines Park. Obviously, Ian is a grand and respectable name in your household, but it's absolutely true, Ian, that there were a couple of years there were no Ians on that list of births registered, and it was during the time that Ian Duncan Smith had taken over leadership
the quiet
of the
man.
Conservative, but was so quiet that nobody could hear the names. So that's just one that had stuck in my memory, but of course it's a fantastic name, whether or not you have one eye in it or two.
Yeah. Names are, I always thought that naming children was going to be fun, but actually it's a massive responsibility, and you there's a lot riding on your decision, isn't there?
Yes, unless you choose to go down that kind of dynasty road going, Jane Susan Garvey the Third, which shows a distinct lack of imagination. And also, I just think at family gatherings, that must be so odd. If you want to tell somebody off or just pass them the Brussels sprouts, there must be so much confusion.
I don't want to believe this, but Katie chimes in with, good afternoon, Jane and Fee. My daughter, who's a social worker, once worked with a young girl, a long time ago it was, and her name was DKNY, pronounced Decaney.
Okay. Well, those kind of things are happening a lot, aren't they? There's definitely somebody in our neck of the woods who's called Abercrombie. And I suppose
it was
originally a name, but then became a famous brand name, maybe with a brother called Fitch, I don't know.
Right, OK. I was given the name Janet when I was born, never liked it, changed my name to Alexandra when I was 60, and I wish I'd done it years before, says Alex.
So you can become Bernard at a time of your choosing.
I don't know. Don't get complicated. We don't want to inflame any recent culture wars. Let's go back to the story in Milan. And our colleague, journalist James Imam, is here to tell us about a strange man, let's just be honest, who turned up at the local town hall pretending to be his mother in order to claim her pension. Tell us more about it, James.
Strange Man is absolutely perfect. I think that hits the ball on the head. What appeared to be a normal ID card request in a small town of about 15,000 named Mantova in northern Italy turned out not to be quite that. And as you said in your introduction, staff at the town hall became very suspicious because the person they had in front of them didn't quite match the person that was on this ID card they were being asked to renew. So that piqued their suspicions and things developed from there, really.
Now, if you care to go to thetimes.com, you will see the images of mother and son side by side. And I suppose, loosely speaking, there's a sort of similarity. You can probably tell they're related. But can you just describe the disguise of the son?
So the disguise of the son, I suppose, was simple and elaborate and well thought out all at the same time. I mean, if you compare the two pictures, because, of course, this story really blew up when an Italian paper, Corriere della Sera, managed to get hold of two pictures, one of the mother and one of the son, two passport-style photos, and placed them side by side. And I suppose, you know, the son, a man in his 50s, does look quite similar, as you said. He's got a hairdo that looks quite similar, brown hair cut in a sort of a shortish bob. Facial structure seems quite similar. He's got a bit of lipstick on. He's got earrings. He looks the part, I suppose. He's a sort of a frumpy Italian woman in her 80s. He's got a colourful blouse on, a long skirt, apparently. And so I suppose, you know, I mean, if this man walked into the town hall and sat next to you while you were waiting to renew your ID card, you may not think anything was particularly amiss. But they sort of felt, the staff at the town hall, that there wasn't quite something, there's something quite that wasn't quite right.
Yeah.
And it was perhaps the age, first of all. I mean, this didn't seem to be an 85-year-old woman.
No. Right. I mean, so I'm afraid, inevitably, there's a slightly sinister side to this. The authorities went to his home and discovered what?
So the authorities were alerted. The man, the woman, as they thought may be the case at this time, was sent away and asked to come back in a week's time to pick up his ID card. By that time, they had alerted the authorities and there was an undercover police officer waiting for him at the town hall. He was interviewed there. The 85-year-old woman, who turned out to be a man in his 50s, revealed his true identity. And then the police officer said, OK, well, we're going to have to go to your house now and check out what's there. So he reluctantly took along the police officer there. And it didn't take them too long to find that the man's mother's corpse had actually been stashed away, wrapped in bed sheets and covered in two sleeping bags. And there was the mother's corpse. So, I mean, what seems to be the most likely explanation here is that the man let his mother pass away. If he didn't actually kill her, that's going to be hopefully determined with a post-mortem, and simply left her there and didn't declare her death, which allowed him to continue claiming her pension, which right. is what this is all about.
Well, for what it's worth, I gather there were no particular financial problems here. This man, I mean, you never need to do harm to anybody else, obviously, but there was no particular desperation in his life, as far as anyone was aware.
Yeah, I mean, he's been described as a nurse, an unemployed nurse. He was getting a pretty healthy pension off the back of this, €53,000 a year. That was both his mother's pension and his dead father's widow's pension, which was going to his mum. So, I mean, that was pretty healthy. But no, the town hall have done their checks and they've seen that it was a pretty wealthy family. They had three houses, a bit of land, which also brought in a bit of cash. So, I mean, perhaps that's what it was. I mean, there was a great temptation there for this man to keep pocketing this money.
Thank you very much. That's James Imam, a journalist in Milan. Yet another attempt by us to just lighten your mental load, which has ended up just making us all a little glum.
I know. So these stories look great on the surface,
sort of,
and underneath
do.
A terrible, terrible dark underbelly of the world and the human mind. But let's cheer ourselves up with a thought from Frank, who says it's worth remembering that Neville Neville is the father of Gary and Phil Neville. Now that's weird.
Yes.
And Russell's got the same thing going down. So
Russell's surname is Russell. He's a Russell Russell.
He's a Russell Russell. You see, that is a bewildering one for me. Why would the parents... I've never understood names, if I'm honest, and I don't want to cause offence, like David Davis and Harry Harris. Because you think, why?
Yeah. You'd just want a bit more choice in your life,
just
wouldn't you?
A little bit of variety. I mean, I'm no maverick, but just a sprinkling of something. Something
I can
extra.
See you as Garv Garvey, though.
Yeah, well, why not?
Well, actually, on the podcast, you've been Lady Garv Garv for years. Mm. Coming up, we're going to talk about health news, and that will include a really important story that we've been covering this week. Rishi Sunak joins the campaign for prostate cancer screening. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance. When it comes to must-listen and mid-morning radio, we've got you covered. There's world-class journalism to broaden your mind, in-depth discussion that gets right to the heart of the issues, and entertaining conversation guaranteed to tickle your funny bone.
And it can be quite humorous.
Hugo Rifkind, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance. Let's get growing.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Stand out without splashing out in the Furniture Village Black Friday sale with unmissable savings on sofas, dining, beds and bedroom furniture delivered in time for Christmas. The Furniture Village Black Friday sale ends Monday.
Nice. Direct Line just sorted me a courtesy van while they're fixing mine after my accident. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like clients paying you on time. All done.
Brilliant. Your invoice is all paid up, left you 5-star reviews. Oh, and a bit extra in there for staying late that time. And I baked this cake for you too.
Nice.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Comprehensive cover required. Courtesy van limited for up to 21 days if your van is written off, stolen, or you use your own repairer. Excludes windscreen claims.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as Saints, could help. Saints has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. Saints is managed by Bailey Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baileygifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Well, the plot's getting very thick now because I misinterpreted Russell's original message to us, which was he had just one name, Russell. In fact, he's just Russell. He's not Russell Russell. He's just Russell. But we're struggling with that, Russell, because presumably you do have to fill in both boxes when you go to register a child. So you do have to give a first name of sorts. So what happened there? Please get back in touch. Let's talk health news. Rishi Sunak is leading a cross-party group of 125 MPs urging the Health Secretary to introduce prostate cancer screening on the NHS. Let's talk to Dr. Rachel Ward, our resident GP. We've talked about the treatment for prostate cancer and this PSA test quite a lot over the last couple of months with you, Dr. Ward. Tell us a little bit about how you feel the debate is being moved on by these incredibly well-known people telling us their stories. And overwhelmingly, Rachel, they do seem to want the current system of testing to change.
Good afternoon. Yes, this really has been an evolving debate. And the things that have changed recently. So we know that the recommendations will be announced later this week from the National Screening Committee about how we move forward with prostate cancer screening. As you say, Rishi Sunak is leading a cross-party group of 125 MPs. And this week we have also heard the announcement from David Cameron, Lord Cameron, that he has also had treatment for prostate cancer, which yet again has raised the awareness of this. I think there are some very interesting points being made. And what Rishi Sunak's group has particularly said, that they feel that there is some new compelling evidence to support testing of high risk groups. But also it's that they feel that this is really leading at the moment. Our system is leading to a real health inequality when it comes to prostate cancer, because at the moment you can request a PSA blood test from your GP. But we know that this is happening significantly more in affluent populations. And what we are seeing is that we are getting higher death rates of prostate cancer in our deprived areas. So this is a classic health inequality that is continuing to evolve. And they are saying that, you know, there are developments that we are working with out-of-date evidence, and they are really encouraging Wes Streeting to take a really bold step in changing the approach almost before all the evidence is there, which I think is very interesting. I think I always feel slightly uncomfortable when evidence-based decisions have kind of political pressure, if you like. But I think there are some really good points when it comes to the health inequality element.
Sure. And just remind us of what the downside of universal testing of men for prostate cancer might be.
Sure. So the PSA blood test has some real downsides, that it is not brilliant at detecting prostate cancer, but also you can get a lot of false positives. So it can be elevated for multiple reasons. Previously, the next step of investigation was just to go directly for a prostate biopsy, which is a really invasive, unpleasant test. So you were really kind of signing up to that if you wanted to get a PSA blood test. We now have really moved forward with prostate MRI screening, which is quick, painless and non-invasive. So there is new kind of evidence and studies underway that the combination of these tests is adequate to use the PSA more extensively.
Is it going to cost an absolute fortune to provide the kind of facilities that would be needed for those MRI scans, which are presumably far more complex than just the PSA blood test?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that will be part of the consideration of calculations. I don't know the answer to that. But what I would say is that we have to always consider the cost of treating people for cancer, which is very, very expensive. And it also has the expense of not being able to work, you know, long term sickness, people potentially not working again, and premature death in some cases. So that has its own costs associated with it. So all of those things have to kind of go into that calculation.
And do you know what, Rachel? We should just say thank you, shouldn't we, to all of the very prominent men who are coming forward and being so honest about their prostate cancer diagnoses. In previous generations, it has not been a particularly easy thing for men to talk about, has it?
Oh, definitely. And I think, you know, incredible how open David Cameron has been, and very matter of fact. For example, Chris Hoare, you know, so many people. This has seen previously, you know, 10 years ago, it was still a really awkward thing to talk about. And I think we have come on so far with awareness and openness about talking about prostate cancer. And that can only be a positive thing.
Right. Let's stick with some good news. Hope is being given to leukemia patients after a drug saw 77% of sufferers entering remission. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so this is a really exciting progress in a drug. Now, leukemia is a very, very complicated group of diseases. It's not one disease. And we are specifically talking here about adult B-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So there are lots of types of leukemia. Now, this type of leukemia in adults is very aggressive. And unfortunately, the median survival in people who get it is less than a year. We do have combinations of chemotherapy, but it is very, very difficult to treat and prolong life. There is a new treatment which has been developed in the UK. It's called, I think you pronounce it, Obe-cel. It's been developed by a company called Autolus, a spin out of UCL. So very exciting, British development. And basically what it does is it takes some of your own immune cells out of your system. It modifies them and then returns them to the body where they are better, essentially, at killing off cancer cells. So such incredibly clever technology. And what they found that 77% of people in the trial did enter remission. And overall, half of the people who were in the trial are still showing no signs of cancer after 3.5 years, which, considering the prior figures, is incredible. But they think on average it increases life expectancy by about 15 months. So, you know, this is incredible science. It's a very unpleasant disease. But, you know, every new treatment that we get in the whole range of leukemia is just very, very positive.
Absolutely. And I was reading a bit more about this, and anyone who is interested can read about it on thetimes.com. And actually, some of the patients say what's been remarkable is to have so few side effects, which, you know, must be so, so important, especially for very young people who, you know, have suffered these really debilitating side effects in the past. Disappointment, though, for our final story. And this is all about the wonder drugs of, you know, the weightless drugs that have been prescribed to people where they've thought, actually, this is helping some other disease that my body is suffering from. But there's some bad news on that front.
Yeah, so there was some indication that GLP-1 drugs, so semaglutide, tirzepatide, we also think of as Ozempic and Wegovy, there was some feeling that it was potentially also having a positive impact on Alzheimer's, dementia. But a trial has now been carried out, the EVOKE trial, and it looked at a range of adults with mild dementia and cognitive impairment. And though it did show that, you know, markers of kind of chemical markers of the dementia were slowed down, this did not, unfortunately, translate into seeing any clinical benefit with the progression of the disease. Now, yes, this is disappointing, but what we have to see is there are so many trials that go ahead and we don't necessarily find a treatment, but every single study gives us more information about that disease, about potential drugs. And there are 130 Alzheimer's drugs in trial at the moment, 30 of which are in late stages. They will not all end up being treatments, but every bit of research just continues to give us more insight and understanding of the disease.
Rachel, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Dr. Rachel Ward is our resident GP and also co-host of the Pharmacy podcast. If you want to have a listen in, it's Pharmacy, spelled F-A-R-M-A-C-Y, because it's about farming as well as pharma.
Thank you. Russell's back. The rule now is that you need both a forename and a surname, but that wasn't always the case, and my legal name really is just Russell. On my driving licence, the name is blank. On my passport, it's filled with X. I am, in fact, a mononym, he says. Do you know who another example of a mononym?
Madonna.
Michelangelo.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Yes, I'll give you Maradona. Did you say Maradona?
No, so it's tempting to say Madonna.
Madonna.
But Maradona will do as well. We'll move off the M's later on in the show.
It's 3 o'clock. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until four. In the next hour, a big story breaking. Jury trials could be abolished for all but the most serious crimes, we're told. We'll hear in a moment from the former director of public prosecutions, Alison Saunders. Reports in the States of a breakthrough potentially in peace talks to end the war in Ukraine. We'll talk to the Times Washington correspondent, Lara Spirit. And our big interview after 3:30 is with the businesswoman and Lady Mayor of London, Dame Susan Langley. That's all ahead. First the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, wants jury trials to apply only to murder, rape or manslaughter. He says the change is necessary to clear a backlog in the courts. More details from Times Radio's Laura Cook.
The Times has seen a memo in which David Lammy says to other ministers drastic action is needed because Crown Courts in England and Wales are clogged up. He's told other government departments there's no right to jury trials in the UK. Should his decision be implemented, it would create a new tier of court in which which serious criminal offences will be tried by judges alone. That goes well beyond the recommendations of Sir Brian Leveson, who was commissioned to review criminal courts and reported in July. The move will require primary legislation, which is planned for early next year.
US media is reporting that Ukraine has agreed to a peace deal brokered by the Trump administration. CBS News says there are some minor details to be ironed out, but an agreement has been reached. Ukraine's national security chief says Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to visit the US at the earliest possible date. A virtual meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, led by Britain, France and Germany, is being held this afternoon. Military analyst Professor Michael Clark says the group is operating as a backstop.
The Coalition of the Willing is to add diplomatic weight behind Ukraine to indicate that if all of this goes wrong, which I think it's still likely to, if there is no peace deal, that we, the Europeans, will still support Ukraine if Ukraine feels it cannot surrender. It must carry on the war. That's always been the message, that you know, we'll help in any way we can if there is a peace deal. If there is no peace deal, we still will support Ukraine.
Pre-prepared milkshakes and iced coffees will no longer be exempt from a tax on sugary drinks. The health secretary's confirmed the move ahead of tomorrow's budget. It's part of an expected £30 billion of tax rises in Chancellor Rachel Reeves's statement to the Commons. Former Conservative Cabinet Minister Jacob Rees-Mogg fears that workers and businesses are going to be penalised.
People who are genuinely disabled need proper support, but that doesn't mean we should have a scrounger's budget, which is what we're about to get, that the incentives not to work are going up, the incentives to work are going down, and businesses' ability to employ people is going down. This is a terrible way to run the economy.
A man's been arrested in connection with the illegal dumping of rubbish in Oxfordshire. A 40-foot mountain of waste near Kidlington was declared a critical incident last week by the Environment Agency. Graham Linehan has been cleared of harassment but found guilty of criminal damage to a trans activist's phone. The comedy writer was involved in a confrontation at a conference in London last October. And a surgeon who led the UK's first successful human heart transplant has died at the age of 93. Sir Terence English's daughter Mary says her family is immensely proud of him. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Well, you're being delightful this afternoon. We will do a full roundup of all of the names that you've heard. To be honest, we don't really care if they're apocryphal tales. They're making us laugh this afternoon.
Please don't think we're going to fall for all of this. I mean, we are, you know, between us, I think our combined age is 809. We're not falling for it. Okay.
No, we're not the person who phones the pub and says the name that gets shouted out. We're not those kind of girls. Right, it's 4 minutes past three. Important news this afternoon. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, as you've heard in the news bulletin, is proposing that trials by juries are scrapped except for the most serious cases, including rape, murder and manslaughter. In a memo seen by The Times, the Deputy Prime Minister wrote to officials in all government departments this month to say that there was no right to jury trials in the UK and that action is needed to cut the backlog of cases. Well, let's talk now to Dame Alison Saunders, former Director of Public Prosecutions. A very good afternoon from us. First of all, what do you make of this?
Good afternoon. I'm really surprised that David Lammy has gone this far. This isn't what Leveson in his review recommended. Without doubt, something fundamental needs to be done and something quite dramatic needs to be done to improve the criminal justice system, because we've seen now there's a sort of a record-breaking 80,000 backlog of cases in the Crown Court and cases taking up to 4 years coming to trial, which, of course, doesn't help confidence in the criminal justice system, doesn't help either victims, complainants, witnesses, defendants. It doesn't help anybody. But to suddenly sort of say we're going to do away with jury trials in the majority of cases, I think is a reaction that is surprising and I'm not sure bears real examination, although obviously, we haven't seen any of the research in the background that's gone into it by the government.
Sure. But just taking what we do know, and I absolutely hear you when you say it's not that much at the moment, when the Justice Secretary says that there's no right to jury trials in the UK, is that actually true? Where does it say, given that we're not a country with a constitution, that there is a right to jury trials? How has the current system come about?
Yeah, well, exactly that. I mean, we don't have a constitution, so there's nothing you can point to that says you have a right to a jury trial. But we have had jury trials for over 800 years. They were first introduced, I think, in Saxon Britain. And it is a fundamental feature of our system. So if you look at some of our greatest legal minds, so Lord Denning, for example, called jury trials the bulwark of our liberties. And Heather Hallett, who's doing the COVID inquiry at the moment, in a lecture she did, she talked about trial by jury increasing participation in democracy through giving a central role to the public in the criminal justice system and how important that was. So I think it's pretty sort of, it's dancing on the head of a pin to say that there is no right. And I think there's quite a lot of academic debate about it. But, you know, it is a fundamental principle of our system that you have a right to be trialled by a jury in certain cases, not all cases now, because in magistrates' courts you don't. So there is, but, you know, it's been accepted for 800 years that that right has existed. And I think to sweep away a fundamental principle of the system because of practicalities, and that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about principles. We're talking about practicalities, I think, is quite worrying.
What would the alternative be apart from just vast amounts of money? And actually, vast amounts of money don't always solve a problem.
No, they don't. And it's not very clear, indeed, how much saving there will be with this intermediate tier, because there will still be trials. You still need court space. You still need judges. You still need, as far as I am aware, two magistrates sitting there with a judge. So you will still need to do trials. So it's still going to take time and resources. What's not clear is how much the government actually think doing it this way will save as opposed to jury trials. But there are other things that can be done. And Leveson, in fact, talks about other things in his review. And he's still got a second part of that review to look at. So again, it's slightly surprising that the government have leapt to this sort of quite extreme sort of recommendation. But there are things that can be done. So we can look again, and I think the government is doing this at the sentencing in the magistrates' courts. We can look again at potentially readdressing whether some offences should be in the magistrates' courts or the Crown Court. There are things such as making sure we do away with warned lists, which is a sort of feature of the Crown Court, where for 2 weeks, a number of cases are put into a warned list and everyone hangs around to see whether or not their cases are heard or not. And that doesn't seem to help. Things like the prosecution giving the defence sort of clearer evidence of what their case is at an earlier stage, and judges really narrowing down the issues with all parties so that you sort of only go to trial in those cases that really need to. There are lots of practical things that can be done that are in the Leveson review and have been suggested by others.
Where would the guardrails be against a judge having bias or simply being perceived to have bias? Is it possible to have a kind of safety net there?
And that's the difficulty, really, is that the trial by jury, I think, has been seen traditionally as the safety net, because, and indeed, David Lammy himself did a review, which I participated in when I was, I think, DPP, the CPS did. But he did a review there of sort of racial disparity in the justice system. And one of his conclusions was that jury trials really were the only part of the sort of criminal justice system that was perceived, not necessarily that it was, but perceived as being free from racial bias, because it's made up of society who represents the defendants and those who are taking part in the criminal justice system. Whereas judges, I think the latest figures were sort of something like only 12% of judges came from racial minority backgrounds. So there's quite a sort of big issue with perception there, which David Lammy knows very well because of his review that he did before. So, and I think there is a real issue about how that will play out with just this intermediate court. And having magistrates, two magistrates there, I don't think will necessarily help, because although the magistracy has made lots of steps to become more diverse, they still are not representative of the society that they serve. So I think there's a real issue there about, will people really trust the justice system and will they see this as having the ability to have a fair trial?
And as you said right at the beginning, Dame Alison, actually for many people, it is only when they sit on a jury or know someone who sat on a jury that they will feel that they've been in any way part of our criminal justice system, unless they are a victim or a perpetrator within that system. So there is a cohesion there as well, isn't there, that maybe doesn't get talked about enough. I mean, one of the barriers to that is that when people come off a jury, they cannot talk about that particular case. So it's a quite a hidden part of our society, isn't it?
It is, and I think that's one of the reasons why the justice system has had so many cuts and nobody has really sort of, nobody outside the profession has really sort of not bothered about it, but really sort of accepted the implication of the cuts, because the health service is different. Everybody knows about the health service. Everybody has either been treated by it, works in it, or has somebody who's been treated by it, and therefore we all care deeply about it and want to see it resourced. The criminal justice system, luckily, not many people were actually come into contact with it, unless, as you say, they're members of the jury, they're unfortunate enough to be a witness or be in a case, or they're a profession. So it doesn't get talked about in the same way, and nobody, there's not the same sort of concern about the years of underfunding that there have been, which is what has led us to this sort of crisis now.
And how do we compare to other countries? How many similar countries still have a jury system?
Well, other countries, it's very difficult to compare, because you'd have to compare us to other common law countries. So Europe has a very different system. I mean, Scotland still has a jury system, but they don't have 12. I think they have 10 on their juries for some reason. But other Commonwealth countries do still, I think, have jury systems. So it's difficult to sort of compare and contrast. But, you know, we've had jury systems for 800 years and lots of Commonwealth countries have copied us. And that's why they have jury trials.
You succeeded Keir Starmer as Director of Public Prosecutions. How comfortable do you think he will be with this?
I mean, I think he will appreciate, he knows that we, that something has to be done, that we can't continue with the sort of 4 years waiting for trials, because that's somebody's life, more than one person's life, you know, it's sort of a number of people's lives that have been affected and are waiting. So that can't continue. You know, I think it's really difficult. They obviously don't have a massive pot of money that they could just sort of scoop out a few million pounds to put into the criminal justice system, which is what it needs. So I'm not sure how comfortable he will be with it. I know he will care passionately that something has to happen and we can't keep going on like this, but I really don't know how comfortable he will be with this. As, you know, with the Lord Chancellor, I mean, David Lammy and his sort of work on disparity and racial disparity in the criminal justice system slightly sort of now clashes with this recommendation. So I can see why they think they need to do something, which they do. I'm just not sure this is the right thing. And to me, it feels like a sort of knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah. And you know, given everything that we've talked about with regard to how invested the average person in this country feels in the criminal justice system, do you have a fear that if this goes ahead, actually people won't really recognise the serious nature of the change until bad stories start to come through about feelings that a system has failed exactly us, our, you know, the average citizen in the country?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that will happen. And also people won't appreciate it until they are, you know, either a defender or a witness that are waiting for a case to be heard and thinking, who are these three people who are here hearing my case? It's a judge and two magistrates. And I'm not sure that they, I've got that trust in them. And we know that trust across the public is quite low in the criminal justice system, which is partly a knowledge thing, but also partly, I think, because they don't necessarily see themselves reflected. So I do think people will not appreciate the issues and the sort of magnitude of this recommendation until it actually happens. We either start hearing bad stories or they actually are part of a case where they end up with no jury at all and have no right to have a jury.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to us this afternoon. That's Dame Alison Saunders, former Director of Public Prosecutions. We would love your thoughts on this. It's 0333 003 2353. If you need to write us a longer missive, then you might want to use our email, which is janeandfee@times.radio.
Just having a quick look, and Canada has quite a proud tradition of judge-alone trials, which, I mean, I suppose I think of Canada as a country in some ways linked to us. Anyway, it's really interesting. If you've got any personal experience of this, or if you've been on a jury recently and frankly you didn't feel it worked all that well, there's a limit to what you can say, but you can broadly outline what your thoughts were, can't you?
Yeah, I think Dame Alison's last point is perhaps the one that we all really need to focus on. If you do end up in court and you're relying on the criminal justice system to find you that justice, and you find yourself looking up at the bench and nobody looks like you, sounds like you, would have had any of your own life experiences, that surely puts a gap between you and your belief in the right verdict being achieved. That's a natural human reaction, isn't it? But if you look to the 12 good men and women and you do see people who you think, okay, well, you might understand a little bit more about what's happened here.
Yeah.
Perhaps you feel a little bit more comforted by that. Well, I've never been in a court as a victim or a perpetrator, Jane, so no. I'm hazarding this position.
Well, I do know someone who was on a jury recently, and I think it's fair to say that they were a bit ambivalent before it started. But then, when it got going, they actually found it rather a profound and positive experience. Genuine mix of humanity on the jury. Everyone took it seriously. And it was something that, at the end of it all, I think they felt rather pleased they'd done it. So anyway, it's a massive change if it does happen. And I imagine there'll be a huge kerfuffle when it gets to Parliament. Plenty of people weighing in there. And you can weigh in now, she said in a DJ kind of a way. 0333 003 2353. You'll still send us silly names. And I just want to mention Shabana, where is it? Oh, this did make me laugh. Shabana said that somebody transferred from an American office to the London office of her company, and their name was Randy Sarah. And it got people talking. Right, what are you listening to? You're listening to Times Radio. And coming up, reports of a breakthrough. This is another big news story in the peace talks that might end the war in Ukraine. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The Budget 2025 on Times Radio. Tomorrow afternoon, Hugo Rifkind will bring you the budget statement from Chancellor Rachel Reeves, live from 12:30, followed at 1 by Joe Coburn and Andrew Neil with a special budget programme featuring expert analysis on all the announcements. Then from 4, John Pienaar brings you Drive Live from Westminster with a full roundup of all the political reaction. The Budget 2025, tomorrow afternoon on Times Radio.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly, so must we. Just £30 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £30, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Feig Lover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 80 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
Sue, very good afternoon to you. Sue says, I once worked for a guy who swore that his friends, whose surname was Flett, had twins who they'd named Lee and Pam. It made me laugh, even if it's not true. Made us laugh too, Sue.
Yeah, very good. I mean, also inoffensive. Right, now, a big news this afternoon, and let's all cross our fingers about this. The White House is hailing what it calls tremendous progress in talks to end the war in Ukraine. In a statement on X, Donald Trump's spokeswoman said that just a few delicate but not insurmountable details remain to be sorted out in further talks. That is Caroline Levitt. Let's talk to Lara Spirit, who is Washington correspondent for The Times. So that statement on X came very recently, didn't it, Lara?
Yes, it did. It came, less than half an hour ago. And of course, it comes at a pretty critical juncture for those peace talks at a moment when negotiators from the US, chief among them, Army Secretary Driscoll, have been dispatched to talk in Abu Dhabi with Russian negotiators. And at a time when, as you say, the plan has been whittled down to those 19 points, when it's unclear if Russia is going to accept it, and when it's also unclear when Trump will speak to Zelensky. So at the moment, nothing is guaranteed, but it does seem like we had a post from Trump himself on Truth Social yesterday indicating that he thought progress could be ahead. And of course, we've just had this from Caroline Levitt saying a few but not insurmountable details. Of course, she did say something quite similar to this yesterday when she said that there were a few outstanding points. But nonetheless, it definitely signals that at this point in time, the White House is optimistic there might be a breakthrough soon.
OK, but no word from Russia at all.
No, I mean, we have had an indication from some reporting. Of course, the BBC has been reporting on what some of the Russian newspapers and media outlets are saying there, which indicate that whittling this down to 19 points may be unacceptable to Russia. In fact, because a number of those things that have been reportedly stripped out, including those kind of more maximalist territorial concessions and questions of future NATO membership for Ukraine, are things that Russia, you would expect, would want to be in this plan. So still some outstanding points they need to get right.
Right. Now, you mentioned this name of Driscoll in Abu Dhabi, the American representative talking to the Russians today. I confess I hadn't heard of this person. Who is he?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So he is a businessman. He's a lawyer. He's a former officer in the military. He is, he's fairly young. He's only, I think, 38 years old, if I'm correct, 39 years old. Sorry, forgive me. And he is a former Yale classmate of J.D. Vance, the vice president. And he was actually dispatched on a trip that was supposed to be concerning procurement for Ukraine, not this massive question negotiations over the future peace plan. But at this point, he has been flung into the very centre of the questions around resolving this conflict and has been dispatched to have high-level negotiations with Russian diplomats at this crucial time. So all eyes on Driscoll, someone who most people in Washington will have been aware of, but who at this point is now definitely up there with the more significant figures of this administration.
Right. It's very interesting, isn't it? And he is the Army Secretary officially. So I suppose people are going to be wondering, what about the Defence Secretary, Pete Hegseth? Where's he?
Well, Pete Hegseth is currently busy talking about an issue that has massively incensed a number of Republicans, including President Trump and indeed Caroline Levitt, who just mentioned the White House press secretary, which regards a video that some Democrats made. I don't know if you've seen this before, but where they spoke about the possibility that those in the services should disobey orders that they think are illegal. And that has sparked off a huge amount of controversy, with Republicans saying that amounts to a kind of defiance of the commander-in-chief power that President Trump has, and Democrats saying actually it's a restatement of the law, which is to say you don't have to follow laws if they're illegal. But equally, those Democrats are not saying if they believe any of these orders so far have been illegal. So that's a massive controversy. Pete Hegseth leading the charge against these Democrats at the moment, and as you say, Driscoll seeming a more significant figure with regard to Ukraine than he does.
Right. So the next step then will presumably be, well, you tell me, who's likely to say something next?
Well, it's a very good question, because we have all of these various diplomatic plates spinning at the moment in circumstances where you have Russian negotiators who are in conversations with the US. You, of course, have a number of important European conversations today as well after those meetings in Geneva, where Marco Rubio, the US Secretary of State, worked with the Europeans to create a plan that was more amenable, it seemed, to the Ukrainians and the Europeans than the previous iteration had been. And then you have the possibility of this meeting between President Trump and Zelensky that's said to be perhaps coming up soon, albeit we know that Trump is heading to Mar-a-Lago, to Florida, for Thanksgiving relatively soon, of course, after the famous turkey pardoning ceremony that we'll be seeing pretty imminently, actually, in the White House.
Yeah, Thanksgiving is Thursday, isn't it? Yeah, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I mean, we shouldn't kid ourselves. It's not a level playing field, this, is it? Because Putin presumably would be more than happy to carry on the war. I mean, the man's a tyrant. He doesn't care. He doesn't have to answer to anybody. But Zelensky, if he doesn't agree to this peace deal, he knows he's likely to lose American support. He's got to go for it, hasn't he?
Well, it's difficult for Zelensky, because he knows that he can't dismiss this plan outright, that it would be very difficult to do that. But he also knows, as he said in that statement over the weekend about Ukraine's dignity being on the line, he knows that it's also very important to make sure that what the Ukrainians have been fighting for years now is front and centre of the minds of negotiators when they are making this plan. So, yeah, it all just depends on what happens now. But Zelensky making, I think, very careful in the past to thank President Trump. And if he does have a meeting with President Trump, you would expect that he would be taking more of an attitude perhaps of recent meetings with him than he would with that the previous Oval Office meeting, where he had that famous dressing down from both Trump and Vance, followed by a lot of European diplomacy to try and get those two leaders back around the table and on good terms again. So I think people will be hoping that Zelensky and Trump, as and when they do come together to discuss this conflict, that it will be on better terms rather yeah. than what.
But there must be doubts about Zelensky, about his ability to stay in power in Ukraine if he does go for this.
Well, of course, he's also separately battling, you know, this corruption scandal in Ukraine that has come at obviously a really difficult time, given how critical a juncture we're at in the wider peace conversation. That obviously domestically has made questions about politics very difficult. But more broadly, and with regard to this conflict at the moment, he will be focusing on the finer details of this. He, of course, has a huge amount of support from European leaders who have been foursquare behind him and who have been, of course, you know, speaking to the administration and the Americans about how best to proceed with this deal. And it did seem, after those conversations between Marco Rubio and Yermak, Zelensky's top aide in Geneva over the weekend, that they had definitely had more positive conversations about this than previous. And there were very effusive words by both of them to that effect. So at the moment, it's very, very hard to say what will happen next. But it does seem, I should say, like that previous deadline, the Thanksgiving deadline on Thursday, you know, Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, appearing to water that down to language around as soon as possible. She said that recently, and also Rubio as well over the weekend, mentioning a number of different days of the week and saying as well they wanted to see it soon. But it seems like the idea that is a hard and fast deadline is falling away now.
OK, really interesting. Laura, thank you very much indeed. That's Laura Spirit, who is the Times Washington correspondent. Sir Keir Starmer has been taking part in a virtual meeting of leaders of the Coalition of the Willing, and he has just said that talks on a ceasefire in Ukraine are moving in what he calls a positive direction. So that would be something, wouldn't it?
It certainly would be. I think you cannot underestimate how important it would be for Ukrainians to be able to celebrate some kind of peace before this Christmas and another harsh, harsh winter of war. Coming up, our big interview after 3:30 is with London's Lady Mayor. And I'm not saying that in a slightly disparaging
gender misogynistic way, she's very happy to be known as the Lady Mayor instead of the Lord Mayor. Three female incumbents of the position before her have had to be called Lord Mayor, so we're calling her the Lady Mayor. And also, why are our pets more like us than we think? It's Variety in the afternoon show. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. David Lammy wants jury trials to apply only to murder, rape or manslaughter. The Times has seen a memo in which the Justice Secretary says to other ministers that drastic action is needed to cut a backlog of cases in Crown Courts in England and Wales. He's told other government departments there is no right to jury trials in the UK. Reports in the US suggest Ukraine has agreed to a Trump administration peace plan to stop the war with Russia. Caroline Levitt, the White House press secretary, has said on X that tremendous progress has been made, but a few delicate but not insurmountable details remain. She says those details will require further talks. Military analyst Professor Michael Clark says we shouldn't get carried away.
Clearly something is happening. I'm pretty sceptical it will do anything other than run into the sand eventually, because I don't think the Russians will agree to it, because the Russians don't want to stop fighting. They think that they'll get more out of continuing to fight, but they don't want to antagonise the United States too much.
Pre-prepared milkshakes and iced coffees will no longer be exempt from a tax on sugary drinks. The Health Secretary's confirmed the move ahead of tomorrow's budget. It won't affect beverages made on site in cafes and restaurants. And a man's been arrested in connection with the illegal dumping of rubbish in Oxfordshire. A 40-foot mountain of waste near Kidlington was declared a critical incident last week by the Environment Agency. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for a Times News briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter. Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
Stand out without splashing out in the Furniture Village Black Friday sale, with unmissable savings on sofas, dining, beds and bedroom furniture, delivered in time for Christmas. The Furniture Village Black Friday sale ends Monday.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Looking for inspiration for your new kitchen? Let Wix help you find brilliant kitchen ideas. Browse the Wix Kitchen Gallery or try the Matchmaker tool to find a style that suits you. Find the gallery and matchmaker at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio. We are talking to the Lady Mayor of the City of London. That's right, isn't it? That's her official title.
That is her official title, yes. Bernard, yes.
Thank you. That is coming up at around a quarter to four. But we're just going to spend a little bit of time indulging ourselves, and hopefully you as well, discussing dogs. Now, Fee is a very proud dog owner.
I've got my Nancy.
Yeah.
Who is a very large greyhound. She's a rescue dog. And in fact, our next guest, I think, has met Nancy. We've talked before about the calm and gentle nature of the greyhound.
Okay. Well, our next guest is Louise Glazebrook, a dog behaviourist and author of Everything Your Puppy Wants You to Know. And she's on because a study has revealed that several genes that shape human emotions are also present in dogs, creating so many different personalities. What do we do with this information, though? Particularly those of us who are dog positive but don't own one. Louise, in a nutshell, does this surprise you? Or I'm sure you've come across all sorts of dogs in your time with all sorts of temperaments.
No, it's not surprising, but I think it's a really lovely reminder that actually when you're choosing a puppy or a dog to live with, actually their genetics matter.
Yeah.
And that they will impact their behaviour, whereas I think sometimes we can forget that.
Yes, I mean, is it true that a dog owner honestly would think that one dog's much like another? Surely not.
It can happen. I don't want to say it doesn't happen. It can. I think especially when you sometimes have owners that maybe have a preference for a certain breed. And so potentially they may have had one breed and then they go in to get others and they can think that they're going to be not exactly the same, but that they are going to be pretty much kind of cutouts of each other. And it can be shocking to people when there are quite distinct differences.
So how do you start training a dog? Do you start on the assumption that it will be biddable, or do you assume that, in fact, it might have a number of issues?
I think if we're looking at it will vary. So if we're looking at a puppy, let's pretend we've got an 8-week-old puppy in front of us. And my version of this is that I never work on the basis of let's start teaching cues, let's start getting them to do things. I work more on the basis of let's build a relationship together. I want you to be confident. I want you to feel safe and secure. How can I do that with you as a puppy, understanding your personality? Because everything else can come from that. Whereas I think a lot of people will start with, right, well, we need to get down and we need to get come and we need to get sit and all these things, forgetting that the dog has a personality and genetics that impact that.
OK, I know you've come across Fee's Nancy, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah, and she is a lovely dog, and she has a, well, how would you describe her nature? Is it like her owner?
Dangerous question. Do you know what, Louise? I think I love this story because I think it just, it informs people's choice about dogs, because I know that you and I have spoken about this before. When a dog is chosen on looks or expectation or size or whatever, and actually not on temperament, that can go so badly wrong for the owner and therefore the dog, can't it? So the more we are aware of the kind of genetic code of different breeds, the happier that bond between dog and owner is going to be.
I completely agree. And I think one of the things that I do is I have breed masterclasses. So they are designed to help owners of certain breeds to understand certain breed traits. Because obviously, I think one thing we can't deny, but which I do see as a problem, is that we as owners forget that we have had thousands of years of breeding to create certain breed traits within dogs. And I think as owners, exactly like you said, we can get caught up in the shape, the size, the colour of the fur, the feel of the ears, the longness of the snout and all of these things. And actually, their temperament and their breed traits are really important for you to try and kind of pair with your own life and think, is this something that I want to put time into? So, for example, with you having a sight hound, it's like if someone doesn't want to spend time on teaching their dog not to chase something, getting a sight hound is probably not the dog for them. And I think the more we understand that, the kind of happier our relationships that can be together.
And I see so many dogs in our local park that to me seem a little bit inappropriate for London living, Louise. And I'm thinking in particular of the kind of sheepdog breeds. I mean, they just, they don't want to trot on a pavement, do they? That's just not, that's not what they think they're here for.
I know what you mean. I do see quite a lot of them pulling owners down the road, eyes darting everywhere, trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, where are the sheep?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, again, it does come down to we can't pretend that these genetics don't play a role. But the thing that I thought was really interesting about this study is that it didn't really touch on, so it talked about human emotions and dogs' emotion, which is great, but it didn't touch on how actually environmental stimulus can also impact a dog's reaction to things. So I think I often see this in puppy owners, where owners don't understand the impact of sleep on their dog's behavior. And that's just one tiny detail. But I think those things are also important because it can change the way their dog behaves and interacts with the world.
So sorry to interrupt. Do some breeds need more sleep than others, Louise, or a different quality of sleep?
It's, well, different age groups will. And I think one of the things when we're looking at, say, an 8-week-old puppy is that if they're awake for 2 hours, then they're going to turn into a demon. Whereas if they are awake for a small period, asleep, awake, asleep, and we kind of go through this Groundhog Day, we will have a much nicer dog to be around and a dog that can do the training and the things that we want it to do. And I think that when we don't understand some of those stimulus and those things that are going on in our lives, then it can be really easy to go, oh, well, this dog is really aggressive, or this dog is really difficult, but I'm really difficult if I haven't slept. And that's the same for our dogs.
And do you think human emotions can rub off on dogs? Let's say, I mean, unfortunately, some people do live in quite fractious households where voices are raised, where there's, I mean, to be even grimmer, sometimes the threat of violence in the air. What does that do to dogs?
I think it will depend. So genetics will definitely play a role in this, in terms of whether they were brought into this as a puppy or as an adult dog. We unfortunately lost our rescue dog a few weeks ago, but Pip was a dog that came to us when he was 7, and he was definitely very fearful of raised voices, and it took many years to kind of teach him that that didn't mean anything bad for him, that didn't mean that he was going to be told off or reprimanded. I think we can also see dogs when they've grown up in fractious households or domestic violence. We can see issues with things like arms being moved. We can see issues with certain genders if there has been a problem within that household. So all of these things will impact our dogs. They learn by association. They learn by how things make them feel and what happens when something happens. And if that keep repeatedly happens, then it kind of becomes generalised that this is what they should take away from that moment.
And just while you're on, Louise, if you don't mind, we are heading to that time of year. I can't believe people still do it, but are there some idiots who buy a dog for Christmas and then get bored by the middle of February because they don't understand the level of commitment?
I mean, I'm definitely seeing, I was doing a little search the other day, actually, on some of the puppy selling sites, and I'm definitely seeing breeders saying that they can be collected around the 23rd of December. Obviously, that's not an ideal time. I also really hate it when you start to see things on social media of someone unboxing a puppy, which is just the most hideous idea ever of this poor puppy contained, having no idea what's going on. But yes, it is still going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Sad, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Louise, thank you very much. Louise Glazebrook, dog behaviourist and author of Everything Your Puppy Wants You to Know. While that was going on, there was some footage coming in from the White House press room of Caroline Leavitt wrangling both her toddler and a turkey. But the turkey and the toddler and Caroline have now left the room.
Who won?
I'm afraid I had to then start talking to Louise Glazebrook, so I can't tell you.
Right. Okay, so the turkey gets pardoned, but then does the turkey live forever? What's the ultimate ending of the turkey pardoning story?
It ends up being elected POTUS.
Yeah. Right. We are Jane and Fee at times.radio. We're 0333 003 2353. We have loved all your comments and your real life or apocryphal names this afternoon. So if you want to chuck a couple more at us, we're here till 4. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Their well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
The Furniture Village Black Friday Sale. Huge savings on sofas, dining, beds and bedroom furniture. But hurry, it ends Monday.
Let's hear from the Chancellor, Geoffrey.
From the Chancellor, Nigel. Chancellor John.
Norman,
Kenneth,
Gordon,
Alistair,
George,
Philip,
Sajid,
Rishi,
Nadim,
Kwasi,
Jeremy,
and now Rachel. Another year, another budget. Over the past 40 years, we've seen it all. Our experts will continue to filter through the noise and uncertainty, helping you make the most of your tax allowances. Hargreaves Lansdown, helping Britain invest through it all. Capital at risk. Tax rules apply and can change.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, Dame Susan Langley is the 697th head of the City of London Corporation and the first to take the title of Lady Mayor. It's much more than a ceremonial role. Her job for the year is to showcase the City of London around the world. And back home, she wants to change our perception of it, that the city is not for everyone. Her own story allows her to do that with bells and chains on. She was born in Whitechapel. After university, she headed to the city via PricewaterhouseCoopers. From PwC, she rose to become Chief Operations Officer at Hiscock. She's also worked at the Home Office, been Chairman of Lloyds Japan, Chair of Gallagher UK. It is quite the CV. All the way through, she's made sure to take women with her, recognising misogyny, and especially misogyny for women who do things with numbers. We recorded this chat last week, otherwise we would have started with a question about Rachel Reeves, but as it was, we started with a question about her title.
To be honest, it never occurred to me to be anything else other than Lady Mayor. We've had a Lady Chief Justice now. We had a Lady Usher of the Black Rod. The legal title is actually Mayor. And, you know, I'm a lady, not a lord. Both can do the role.
So were the previous women who've held the role referred to as Lord Mayors?
They were, and that was their choice. But for me, I'm definitely a Lady Mayor. I think titles make a difference.
In what way?
I think it's showing that anybody can actually do this role. I think it's very important to be yourself, to be authentic, to be genuine. And I'm just obviously a Lady Mayor.
What happens on, let's say, an average Wednesday in the life of a Lady Mayor? What does the job actually entail?
Well, the first thing I can say is there's definitely not an average Wednesday, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday or Friday, so it's completely different. So for the role, you spend 100 days overseas. You travel as an ambassador to promote financial and professional services, whether that's taking a delegation, taking a list of investable opportunities, speaking at a conference. In the UK, it could be anything from hosting a business roundtable. It could be attending a livery dinner. It could be speaking at a conference. It could be bringing a group of school kids in to talk about their career. The brilliant thing about this role is there is absolutely 100% not an average day.
For people who thought, oh my word, I imagined it was just ceremonial, that you do the pomp and the circumstance and the Lord, now the Lady Mayor's show, and maybe get to, you know, have access to a grand house in the city, but you don't have to do very much else. That is absolutely not the case, is it?
It's definitely not the case. I mean, I have to admit, a lot of people think that. I think when I was little, I used to watch the Lord Mayor's show on my granddad's shoulder, and I really remember that. I remember I was always wrapped in a warm scarf because my gran was a prolific knitter. And I used to listen to the horses clock by and the bands and wait for the, you know, the golden coach. And I have to say, as a child, I mean, I never, ever, ever thought I would be in that coach one day. But now I've learned it is not ceremonial. Probably 10% of it is ceremonial, and that's what the public see. But I now find myself... You have quite often some tour guides outside Mansion House, you know, telling groups of people about what the Melty does. And I now find myself wanting to come up behind them and go, no, that's not true. It's not a ceremonial role. It's a business role.
What happens inside Mansion House? Because you're entitled to use that as your residence for the year, aren't you? But, I mean, do you actually have to move in there? Is it modern, Sue?
Fee, it's not modern.
I'm imagining it's not modern.
No, so it's a fantastic place to be. And yes, with a number of evening engagements, we live in Hertfordshire. It makes sense to live there. We actually go home at the weekend. But there are a number of meetings, there are a number of dinners, there are a number of round tables. So it's very much, I like to think of it as the embassy for financial and professional services in the city, because the Lady Mayor is the ambassador for financial and professional services, and that in the heart of the city is the embassy. So There are a few state visit ceremonial occasions, but it's a working house.
Let's get down to talking about business. You have had an astonishing career. You are fully qualified to have this role. So I wonder, with your wealth of experience, where you think London and the UK is right now in terms of its financial services and how the rest of the world is viewing us. We feel quite down about ourselves at the moment. You know, the polls show that. That's not just me saying that today.
I'm incredibly positive about the UK. I think in Britain, we're very, very good at saying what we're not good at, but we are very, very bad at saying what we are good at. So I think the city in London is unrivaled in terms of the ecosystem that surrounds all of our businesses, all the support services, legal, finance. And I think if you look at, there was a recent survey, I think it was CBRE, about the number of deals over 100 million that had come into the city. I think it was zero last year and it was up to six this year when the report was run. There's a lot of confidence and there's a lot of support for the city. But I think one of our problems is we don't talk it up, we talk it down, and that's just wrong. So over the next year, I intend to be far more Tigger than Eel.
Do you find it frustrating then to have a government that has talked it down? When Keir Starmer first came to power, he said there'll be very bad times before we get to the good times. A lot of people feel that there's been more doom than there has dopamine in the message that has come out to all of us. And that is completely different to what you're saying we should be able to do.
I think people have different styles. My style
is... That's such a lovely political way of putting it, isn't
it? People do have different styles. I mean, my role over the next 12 months is to be ambassador for financial and professional services and other businesses in the city. But genuinely, I see a lot of positives about the city. People talk IPOs. I think in the last couple of weeks we've now had three, so there's green shoots there as well, and I think it's really important to support all of our businesses, all of the sports services. It's a great place to live, it's a great place to work, and I still think it's a great place to invest.
What do you want to see from the budget? I mean, if you were still in any of your roles for Lloyds of London, for the Financial Services Organisation, for Gallagher UK, what would you be wanting the Chancellor to give you?
Well, I'm not going to speculate about what's in the budget because there's a lot of speculation out there. But the key message is don't tax growth. So there are some things we could do, removing stamp duty from shares. I wouldn't like to see a bank levy, but it's just really important to support the city. We talk about growth, but what growth actually means is we need to be a place where people want to grow their business or set up their business, which then creates jobs, it creates livelihoods, it puts money back into the economy, and it pays tax. That's why growth is so important.
I love your mottos too, in particular. I don't know how many you've got, but one of them is forgiveness, not permission. What does that really mean on a kind of day-to-day basis?
To me, it means you go with your gut. I mean, you will always try and do the right thing. And actually, I'm a huge fan of consensus. What's the other saying? If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. So I'm a real fan of that. But sometimes leadership is about taking a decision. And taking a decision in some cases depends on how many people you need to bring with you. But if you feel it's the right thing to do, then I've always advocated do it.
The other one is be yourself, everyone else is taken, which I just loved. I'd not heard it put that way before. But that's the same kind of thing, isn't it?
It is, and it was probably taught to me by my dad. I mean, my dad was a sparky, an electrician. And I never realised until I got much older. I said to somebody, oh, anything is possible. I mean, how hard can it be? And they said to me, do you know your dad always used to say that? And I said, really, did he? But obviously it was somewhere in there in my brain. And he gave me that, hopefully never arrogance, but that inner resilience that if you feel something's right, to have that inner confidence to just go ahead and do it. I also say, you know, I have, any one time I've had up to 17 mentorees, because I think we've got a responsibility to help others. Generally, I do think we have a responsibility to help others in life, especially if we've been lucky enough to have great opportunities. We need to make sure that we give those that come after us the same opportunities. But I always say to them, you can get as much help as you can around you, but ultimately, the only person responsible for your career is you. So you've got to be authentic, you've got to be who you are, and just stay true to that. People can tell authenticity.
What do you say to perhaps a young woman or young man you're mentoring who says, I feel a bit intimidated by the city? I know that one of your ambitions this year is to unsquare the square mile, to take away that idea it's a place for certain people. You don't come from a background of public school and privilege. So what is the real life experience that you can pass down about not feeling excluded?
I would say feel brave and step forward. I mean, I found the city incredibly welcoming. I think you go back to, in a way, you go back to your childhood as well and the support you've had, because you said I don't come from a particularly privileged background. Actually, I came from a hugely privileged background because I had two loving parents, a lot of support, brilliant teachers who encouraged me. So I come back to, we need to encourage those others around me. So if I had one of those mentorees, I would absolutely, and I do it, you know, day in, day out. Step forward. Don't be intimidated by the city, because when you're trying to hit objectives, you can hit objectives any way you can. You don't have to copy anybody else. It comes back to the be yourself, everyone else is taken. And I found the city to be incredibly welcoming, especially if you reach out. Most people like to help. I've had some incredible mentors and supporters along the years who've helped me. And I think if they come in, they'd find exactly the same. I have not found barriers in the city, but I do understand some people see it as scary and it's not. So step forward and try.
What would your grandfather, on whose shoulders you sat when you were watching the Lord Mayor show, what would he make of your trajectory? I mean, it's so impressive.
I often think that, or my mum and dad, who never saw it too. I don't know. I mean, I very much hope they would be proud. Perhaps they wouldn't be fazed for it if I come from a family that say anything is possible. I mean, you know, they're all EastEnders through and through. I hope he'd be pleased for me, and I hope he'd think I'm proving that you can do it for others. One of the best things about the show was the number of small kids and girls especially waving and shouting at me. There were a couple of times around the route where a couple of dads or grandfathers, I mean, there were lots of kids on shoulders, but there were a couple of times where a little girl was on a dad's shoulders and the dad pointed at them twice, happened to point it up to them, because they'd obviously read the thing about the grandfather's shoulders, which was very touching, I know. And the next day, I got a huge number of emails from parents saying, you singled out my son, you look soon made the world, my daughter now wants to be Lady Mayor. I actually thought, quit while I'm ahead, you know, after that weekend. But that's what's important. So I hope they would be proud, not of me, but maybe of the impact I've had on a few others.
Mm. Do you think that you would want to change the outfit of the Lady Mayor of London? There's some flounce going on there, isn't there?
I will have you know, I have already changed the outfit of the Lady Mayor of London. So the outer flounce is general and stays, but underneath, as alderwoman, the official dress was a suit similar to an alderman. But I'm pleased to say that I had it translated into a satin dress with all of the same ruffles, but it's much more feminine. The very funny thing was somebody then once handed me a book called Ceremonials that was written in the 1930s. I happened to be flicking through, which mentioned in the event of a female alderwoman, the official equivalent to white tie was long wild tie silk dress. And I suddenly realised it had not progressed, but I'd gone back to 1930.
Right, okay. So not all progress.
No, so I've changed, yes. I have changed the dress to be something a little more modern under the frills.
Under the frills.
Same thing.
Thinking of a different kind of title. That was Dame Susan Langley. We will talk to her again in a year's time to find out exactly what has been achieved during her year as Lady Mayor of the City of London.
Budgettastic here on Times Radio tomorrow in the company of Joe Coburn and Andrew Neil. We'll be back on Thursday afternoon. Who do we want to thank today? Producer Felix Forbes, and our technical operator was Adam Heaton. And who's up next? It's only
John Pina.
Have a good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pina. This is Times Radio Drive. And here are the headlines. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, wants jury trials to apply only to murder, rape or manslaughter. And reports in the US suggest Ukraine has agreed to a Trump administration peace plan to stop the war with Russia. And coming up, a major shake-up to the criminal justice system in Britain. Is this the beginning of the end for jury trials? The Times legal editor will explain the proposal and we'll get reaction from former Justice Secretary Robert Buckland. And we'll find out more about progress towards peace in Ukraine. If there is progress, Kyiv saying they support the essence of a deal. And what rabbits could be left in the hat for Rachel Reeves to put out of her budget speech tomorrow?
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, is proposing that trials by jury should be scrapped, except for the most serious cases, including rape, murder and manslaughter. The Times has seen a memo in which the Deputy Prime Minister wrote to officials in all government departments this month to say there was no right to jury trials in the UK. He also said action is required to cut a backlog of cases. Dame Alison Saunders, a former Director of Public Prosecutions, has told Times Radio it would be a huge change.
We don't have a constitution, so there's nothing you can point to that says you have a right to a jury trial. But we have had jury trials for over 800 years. They were first introduced, I think, in Saxon Britain. And it is a fundamental feature of our system. So if you look at some of our greatest legal minds, so Lord Denning, for example, called jury trials the bulwark of our liberties.
Reports in the US suggest Ukraine has agreed to a Trump administration peace plan to stop the war with Russia. Caroline Levitt, the White House press secretary, has said on social media that tremendous progress has been made, but a few delicate but not insurmountable details remain which require further talks. But a former Ukrainian defense advisor, Yuri Sack, has told Times Radio he thinks his country will still be fighting a year from now.
Everything Russia does demonstrates, regardless of how many versions of a peace agreement we will offer to them, they're not interested in peace, because anything short of full and complete capitulation of Ukraine will not satisfy Russian maximalistic demands. Their objective is the destruction of Ukraine's statehood.
The Health Secretary has announced the sugar tax will be extended to include pre-packaged milkshakes and lattes. The Treasury says sugar consumption by British children is more than double the recommended maximum. Wes Streeting has told MPs that obesity costs the NHS billions of pounds.
We're expanding the soft drinks industry levy to include bottles and cartons of milkshakes, flavoured milk and milk substitute drinks. We're also reducing the threshold to 4.5 grams of sugar per 100 millilitres.
Drinks made in cafes will not be affected. A man's been arrested in connection with the illegal dumping of rubbish in Oxfordshire. A 40-foot mountain of waste near Kidlington was declared a critical incident last week by the Environment Agency. The Paris prosecutor says four more arrests have been made over last month's jewel heist at the Louvre. Two men and two women between the ages of 31 and 40 were detained this morning. It's not clear what role they are suspected of playing. The jewellery, valued at £77 million, is still missing. And Graham Linehan has been cleared of harassment but found guilty of criminal damage to a trans activist's phone. The comedy writer was involved in a confrontation at a conference in London last October. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for a Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pina on Times Radio Drive with IG.
Hello, I'm John Pina with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Well, we're talking war and peace today. How could we not, just as Ukraine and Ukraine's friends in Europe grow fearful that Donald Trump's support may have been shifting and the White House seemed to have grown closer to Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin, well, the picture changes again. And I'll get you right up to date on all of that in just a moment. But first, some news breaking just before we came on air. The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, is floating a radical, even astonishing plan to abolish trial by jury for all but the most serious crimes, murder, manslaughter and rape. Now stand by for a shocked and maybe angry reaction from within the legal establishment and possibly the civil rights lobby, starting perhaps on this programme. Now Lammy, quoted in a memo that's been obtained by The Times, says that there's no right to jury trials in the UK. Isn't that the opposite of what we've always heard? Analysis and reaction for you on that story in a moment. And meanwhile, the war in Ukraine has to end sometime. Why not now? Well, the answer, of course, is that it'll end when Vladimir Putin wants it to end. And the painful truth is there's no sign of the Russian dictator wanting anything but victory in Ukraine, at least an outcome that he can trumpet as victory. Today, though, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is said to be preparing to visit Donald Trump in the White House this week. If they agree on a peace plan, and that is a big if, it'll have to be a lot less pro-Russian than Trump's envoy drew up with Russia last week. Now, it could happen. President Trump is talking up the chances of something good happening sometime soon. And just a couple of hours ago, the BBC reports an unnamed US official saying that Ukraine has agreed to a peace deal, which sounds like a dramatic development. But what exactly has been agreed? And as ever, will President Putin agree against all the odds to compromise on his demands to seize Ukrainian land that his forces have so far failed to conquer? And to leave Ukraine weaker and to extinguish Ukraine's distant dream of joining NATO. Does anyone see Putin doing that? Anyone? And if he won't, can he be made to compromise? Now, in Washington, the demand from Republicans in Congress for Trump to force Russia to the negotiating table has grown louder. So the answers that we're seeking really lie in the hearts and minds of the leaders in the White House and the Kremlin. What are they thinking now? What are they thinking today? I'm going to get you up to date with all of this. I wonder what you're thinking. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, we're going to look at the story in The Times by the legal editor, Jonathan Ames. You can see it there, and I recommend you have a good look. It tells us that the British legal system could be set for a massive overhaul under the proposals drawn up by the Deputy Prime Minister and Justice Secretary. Juries, then, would only decide murder, rape or manslaughter cases under this shake-up, which could, it suggested, could be the beginning of the end for trial by jury. Most cases would be heard by a judge alone, except for those deemed to be in the public interest. And the writer behind that story in The Times is Jonathan Amos, the legal editor, and he joins me here in the studio. Good to see you, Jonathan.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you here, and congratulations on obtaining this document. Can you tell us a bit more about this plan by the Justice Secretary?
I think it certainly is, as you say, a dramatic development. And I think for two reasons, really. First of all, if I can just give you a bit of history, it goes back to an embedded problem in the justice system, which is that there is a growing, and ever since the pandemic, a growing backlog of cases in the Crown Courts in England and Wales. And that backlog has reached nearly 80,000 cases now. And the real life impact of that backlog is that it's delaying trials and delaying serious trials and arguably most importantly rape and sexual offence trials by as long as 2, sometimes 3 years. And yeah, the problem with that is that witness memories fade, sometimes witnesses drop out, and trials collapse. And the old adage that justice delayed is justice denied, etc. So that's the backdrop against which the government is working. And what they did at the beginning of the, or the, sorry, at the end of last year was commission